Okay, so we're supposed to talk in this session about the individual, and I'm going to talk about one factor that causes individual vulnerability to overeating, and that is stress. First of all, Rodolfo Linus, a very famous neuroscientist, always starts his talks with this, the sea squirt, which is a very primitive animal. The larva of the sea squirt has the ability to swim, and it swims around until it finds a rock that is in a suitable area for feeding. Then it attaches itself to the rock, and it never leaves. For the rest of its life, it eats by filtering food. And once it attaches itself, its brain disappears. Similarly, the koala has solved the problem of food by living in its food. And it only eats one thing, and it lives in it. So it has no thinking to do related to food. And indeed, its brain has atrophied as well compared to its nearest neighbors. What you see here is a koala, an MRI of a koala. And the white stuff is fluid. So what you can see is that its skull contains mostly fluid. So the conclusion from this is that the brain exists in order to feed. That's its real function. And obesity is a brain disease, as is diabetes. So I study the brain, and I'm interested in how the brain controls appetite. And I'm going to talk about one particular aspect of appetite control, and that is the response to stress. So I have extra slides that I'm just going to skip. So Donald Hebb, a very famous neuroscientist, the father of modern cognitive neuroscience, proposed that hunger was an addiction. He talks about the salted peanuts paradox, which is that if you see a bowl of peanuts, you can take them or leave them. But once you start eating them, you can't stop. That phenomenon goes against the idea of drive reduction. If the brain was only interested in controlling homeostasis, the more you eat, the less hungry you would get. The salted peanuts paradox is also seen in animals that are trained to self-administer cocaine. Once you prime them with a single dose of cocaine, they start pressing the lever for more and more. So this suggests that there is a link, and there's multiple other evidence to suggest a link between eating and addiction. Hebb proposed that hunger was a learned behavior. He proposed that early in life, the hungry infant is unhappy. He thought that maybe this was because its stomach was empty and the stomach would start to contract and this was painful and unpleasant. In any case, the empty stomach triggers a state of anxiety and stress in the infant. This causes psychomotor agitation, it causes crying, and it causes the mother to feed the child. So the anxiety and the outward manifestations of it cause the child to be fed. This fills up the stomach, and it removes these unpleasant effects of an empty stomach on the brain. It's rewarding, in other words. So the child learns in its first few days of life that a high-calorie food, high-fat, high-sugar food, is an anti-anxiety substance. And it may be that for the rest of our lives, we know that we can reduce our stress, no matter what its cause, by ingesting high-calorie food. And indeed, most comfort food is high in calories, and most comfort food is somehow associated with interaction with the mother from childhood. The act of being fed by the mother is also intrinsically rewarding. There are probably all kinds of chemicals in the brain whose role is to foment bonding that also make the act of eating this very high-calorie food rewarding. Roy Wise demonstrated that blocking dopamine reduces the reinforcing and rewarding effects of food, and he suggested that addictive drugs act on brain circuitry that originally developed to serve feeding behavior. Now, stress. When we think of stress nowadays, we think of usually psychological stress or psychosocial stress, and indeed that is probably the main cause of stress for humans. But the concept in the 19th century was not of necessarily a psychological stress. They didn't even use the word stress, of course, but Bernard thought that the stress that what we think of as stress nowadays was at first a homeostatic derangement, that is, a deviation from the optimal state. For example, thirst, hunger, being cold or hot. Cannon then showed that stress also caused an arousal response. So the effect of stress on the brain was to trigger all kinds of brain systems that are involved in arousing and motivating behavior. Because if you're stressed, it means there's something you need to do right now to avoid the stress, such as find food. And Selye, as you probably know, brought the idea of psychological stress to the table, showed that cortisol was an important mediator of stress, and also demonstrated that chronic stress could have adverse health effects. And one of these effects is obesity. And one way that stress can cause obesity is by promoting overeating. The role of dopamine in feeding and in reward is illustrated here. Rewards, whether drugs of abuse or foods, money in humans, trigger the release of dopamine in the brain, and dopamine is a learning signal that reinforces the behavior that led to the reward. Conditioned stimuli, that is, initially neutral stimuli in the environment that are paired with reward, gradually gain the ability to themselves trigger dopamine. This is what's called conditioning. An example of conditioning is a cigarette smoker who has quit smoking and who sees some cigarettes or who sees someone smoking and experiences a desire to smoke. Another example is you at dessert time when you're completely homeostatically replete in calories and you see dessert, you see chocolate cake, or you see nice appetitive pastries, and all of a sudden that triggers a desire for that food that is not a homeostatic derangement. So we are conditioned to seek rewards. And the other thing that happens is that with time, there's a phenomenon called sensitization, which means a progressively a heightened dopaminergic response to rewards and to conditioned stimuli. The role of dopamine in all this is to trigger wanting, the desire for the reward, and also to motivate the individual. So when dopamine is released, that increases your motivation to work for food. It also increases your motivation to engage in risk. So another parallel between feeding and drug addiction is the idea that during stressful states, during states of craving and desire, an animal or a human is willing to take risks to obtain the reward. And indeed, dopamine seems to push the risk profile towards high-risk behavior. These are two examples from the Planet Earth series, a polar bear attacking an animal that is actually 3 to 4 times its size. Polar bear had not eaten in a long time and therefore was engaging in a high-risk but high-potential reward behavior trying to kill this walrus, couldn't kill it, broke its leg, and died. This really reminds me so much of some of the drug addicts, especially heroin addicts, that I saw as a medical student, who would put themselves through extreme physical risk in order to obtain drugs. The other is of lions attacking, trying to bring down an elephant at a watering hole at night. Another example of feeding-related risk behavior has been studied in birds. There are many birds that change their risk profile as they get hungrier. For example, the chickadee will, if given a choice between two food sources that have the same expected value but different variants, will almost always pick the low variance food source. In other words, birds are risk averse. The chickadee can't feed at night, and so it's very important that it gets enough calories during the day in order to make it through the night. And so as the day wears on, their risk profile actually moves towards the high variance food source. In other words, as the day wears on, the animal is now more prone towards risk. The same thing happens to migratory birds before their migration, and so on and so forth. In other words, the homeostatic derangement, the deviation from homeostasis, promotes increased motivation to seek food, but also increased risk-taking, increased risk-seeking in order to obtain the reward. And that may explain the difficulty people have in losing weight. In other words, even though they're aware of the risks of continuing to overeat, it may be that our biology actually makes us prone towards risk when we're hungry. So you can study the brain response to food cues, condition cues, using functional magnetic resonance imaging. For example, in our studies, we'll show food pictures and scenery pictures and find brain areas that are activated. I don't need to go into details, but basically you can map out the appetitive brain response to food cues. You can also do the same thing with smoking, and there are really great parallels between smoking and eating. I won't go into details, but from the parts of the brain that are activated all the way to what we see now with lobbyists, the tobacco lobbyists are now food lobbyists. There are so many parallels between the two. So we use smoking to try to understand the brain appetitive response. Here is an example where we showed people neutral videos, haircut videos in this case, and smoking videos. They're sort of matched for visual appeal. The only difference between the two videos is that in one people are smoking and in the other people aren't smoking. You show these videos to smokers and they feel like smoking. It triggers a desire for cigarettes, not surprisingly. So what we did is we took smokers and we told them, we don't want you to smoke. Try to refrain from smoking. And then what we did, we stressed them while they were in the MRI scanner. We use a task called the Trier Mental Challenge. It's a psychosocial stress where basically you fail at a certain solving problems while people are observing you. So it involves the ego. And you fail in front of strangers, and that causes stress. It causes an increase in cortisol. And we looked at the brain response to the smoking cues before and after stress and before and after a control task that was matched for everything except it was not stressful. And what we found is that these appetitive brain regions, these parts of the brain that trigger this intense craving incentive response, they were more activated after stress. The effect of stress seemed to be to increase that appetitive response to the cues. In other words, when stressed, a cigarette smoker who is trying to abstain from smoking is more likely to smoke because the smoking behavior is more desirable. We've done the same studies with food and have more or less similar results. Now, finally, I just want to talk about a hormone that may be the stress signal that Donald Hebb was thinking about, and that is ghrelin. So ghrelin, you can see here, is secreted by the stomach, and it enters the bloodstream and acts on the brain. It's a peptide, and it's a hunger hormone. When ghrelin is released, it triggers increase in appetite and increase in food consumption. Ghrelin is released when the stomach is empty, not surprisingly. It's released just before meal times, and in fact, our clocks are entrained. So whatever feeding schedule you're used to, ghrelin will be released from the gut just before you're supposed to eat, and that's why you get hungry. Ghrelin acts on the hypothalamus. It also acts on dopamine neurons and on the reward system to increase the incentive value of the food. But we've shown recently evidence that ghrelin may also be a stress hormone. So we did a study where we showed people food pictures and scenery pictures, and then we administered ghrelin intravenously while they were in the MRI scanner. So we found that ghrelin enhanced the response to food pictures in areas like the amygdala and the insula, areas involved in assigning emotional and incentive value to the food. So that's not surprising. That's why it makes you hungrier. But there's evidence that ghrelin secretion may be under the control of stress systems, such that when we're under stress, the ghrelin response is enhanced. So we did a study where we took students, college students, during exams, which we call chronic stress, and during the academic year when they're not under stress. What you can see on the left is that the students were more stressed during the exam period. And in the middle, what you can see is that before they came to our lab, their ghrelin levels were higher at baseline during the stress day than during the non-stress day. In other words, this hunger hormone, this hormone whose effect is to make you eat more, in fact, not just eat more, but eat more high-calorie foods. It shifts preference to high-fat foods. It's elevated by chronic stress. So this could explain in part why you eat more and you eat more high-calorie foods when you're stressed. But what we also showed is that when we showed food cues to the subjects, food pictures, the increase in ghrelin was also greater during stress. In other words, during periods of stress, not only are you hungrier, but you're hyperreactive to the food cues that are present in the environment. And then the final panel shows that an acute stressor also increased ghrelin levels in the blood. We then wanted to see if ghrelin was having a stress-like effect on the brain, and one way to do this is to measure the response to emotional stimuli. When you show people emotional faces, there's activation of brain regions involved in emotional processing, including the amygdala, a part of the brain that's very important in assigning hedonic value to cues in the environment. So what we saw is that when we showed people negative emotional faces, such as disgust here, or sadness, or fear here, ghrelin enhanced the amygdala response to these negative faces. Now, these are things that have nothing to do with eating. Certainly, fear has nothing to do with eating. But ghrelin, a hunger hormone, enhanced the response to negative emotional faces. It actually suppressed the response to positive emotional faces, like happy faces. So what ghrelin was doing to the brain is shifting attention towards negative affective stimuli. This is the same thing you see in people who are under stress. So if you look at depressed people, post-traumatic stress disorder, anorexia nervosa, they all show the same phenomenon of this bias towards negative emotional stimuli. In other words, we've shown that ghrelin is released by stress, both chronic and acute stress, and we've also shown that it acts on the brain in a way that's commensurate with it being a stress hormone. And this may be the signal that Hebb thought was actually just stomach contractions. So the baby, empty stomach, high ghrelin levels, anxiety, stress, it eats a high-calorie food that suppresses ghrelin secretion, and it signals reward. Now, later in life, when you experience another kind of stress, any kind of psychosocial stress, ghrelin levels are once again increased, and you know through experience that you can suppress these ghrelin levels by eating high-calorie food. This is what I've been saying. Ghrelin is a metabolic feeding signal, but it increases the response to food cues in brain areas involved in motivation and hedonic evaluation, increasing the incentive salience of the food cues. But it may also be a stress signal and could be part of the biological basis for comfort food. Thank you.